Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 41 of Prog Notes. My name is Destin.
And I'm Drew.
And today we are listening to Aqualung by Jethro Tull. If this is your first time listening to our show, welcome. We try to educate and inspire our listeners to uncover and learn about progressive rock music. So we're very honored that you're with us today. We would love to connect with you. So please give us a follow on Instagram, Facebook, or you can join our Discord chat server to talk with Drew and I, as well as many other fans of the show and prog rock. All these links are in this episode's description. And we also want to say thank you to all of our patrons for helping this show and these episodes happen. You can become a patron by visiting our website, prognotespodcast.com, or our Patreon page, patreon.com/prognotes. And we do have one announcement for you guys regarding the show. So stick around till the end because you won't want to miss that. It will be very, very important.
It will so anyway, inform you.
Yes, it will inform you about some information.
important information. Being informed to you by us.
So Aqualung is the fourth studio album by the British band Jethro Tull, released on March 19th, 1971. This is Jethro Tull's best-selling album, selling more than 7 million units worldwide. The members performing on this album include, and I say this because there have been many lineups of the band. First, we have Ian Anderson, who is our lead vocalist, who also plays acoustic guitar and flute. Martin Barre, who plays electric guitar. Jeffrey Hammond, who plays bass guitar, alto recorder, and backing vocals. John Evan is playing piano, organ, and mellotron. And then we have Clive Bunker on drums and percussion. There's also some additional personnel that include Dee Palmer, which did the orchestral arrangements and the conducting for some of the string sections. And I believe later on he was actually became a member of the band. I don't think he was officially a member during this record. So Aqualung has widely been regarded as a concept album, to which the lead singer Ian Anderson has rejected the idea and just said that the album is just a bunch of songs. But Ian Anderson's frustration over the album's labeling as a concept album directly led to the creation of Thick as a Brick, their following record, which was intended to be deliberately over-the-top, in quotations, concept album in response, almost done as kind of a spoof of the genre. And the great news is...
The mother of all concept albums.
The mother of all concept albums, right? The good news is that we've covered Thick as a Brick back in episode 9 of Prog Notes. So after this episode... You can head over to hear that episode and more about its origin because this is the precursor to Thick as a Brick. So this is kind of lining up the history as well as what happened with this record will kind of set the framework for Thick as a Brick. So you guys can go check out episode 9 if you haven't heard it, or maybe you have, and you can get a sort of a refresher on these couple of years of Jethro Tull's career. But for Aqualung, Drew, you want to give us a little bit about what the public's reception was of this record?
Well, like you said earlier, it's their top-selling record. This is their most popular record. And people really like this record. I remember when I was first introduced to this, this was on Guitar Hero?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like this song, right? This song, it was at like a friend's birthday party. They were all playing Guitar Hero when it first came out. I don't know which Guitar Hero. There are several iterations. But
right. That
was the first time I heard this. And if you're on that game, they're popular rock tunes. And so this is a popular rock song and a popular rock record. This was like the landmark record for Jethro Tull, right? So in 1971, it charted at number 3 in Australia, number 3 in Denmark, number 5 in Canada, number 5 in Germany, number 3 in Norway, number 4 in the UK, and number 7 in the US. All of those countries, it was within the top 10. It has sold 3 million copies in the U.S., making it triple platinum. It sold over 250,000 in Germany, making it gold certification over there, and over 100,000 in the U.K., making it gold certification in the U.K.
That is an interesting stat right there. It sold more in the U.S. than it did the U.K.?
Well, yeah, but also think about population.
That's true. Yeah,
yeah, there are way many more people in the U.S. than
yeah,
there are
that's true.
In
I was about
the
to
UK.
Say, I was like, wait, what? Because most of the time, I believe, like, most of it has just been, like, very British. Like, it's been a very European thing. It hasn't necessarily broken.
But
because we
also,
had the stuff going on over here.
we'll talk about this, but, you know, they were very rooted in blues rock and hard rock, and blues is an American origin.
Right.
A lot of people in America were loving the hard rock and were loving the blues rock that was coming out of England. But, you know, the Beatles and Cream,
Led Zeppelin,
Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, all that was very popular in the U.S. as well.
Yeah, yeah,
so, and again, very blues-based music. A lot of those English bands took a lot of inspiration from early rock and roll legends from the U.S.
Yeah.
In the early days. So, yeah, just something to keep in mind. As far as reviews go, AllMusic gave it a 4.5 out of 5 stars. That's the official rating. But the user rating, out of 3,399 users, was a perfect score, or close to perfect score, of 5 out of 5. People love this record. So the official review said that it is widely regarded as Tull's finest hour. The reviewer, which is Rovi? Ravi?
Okay.
Rovi staff asserts that this was not their first full-blown prog album. That would come in their next endeavor, Thick as a Brick. We talked about with the whole mother of all concept records in quotes. That's, you know, in case people don't realize, that's the term that I think Ian Anderson used. We are going to make Thick as a Brick is the mother
of all concept albums.
Again, episode 9, check it out. That's my shameless plug. I have to agree that this record doesn't really conjure the word prog to mind. We'll cover that a little bit later. But Ravi's review was glowing. He said that the lyrical concept, the hypocrisy of Christianity in England, is stronger than on most other 70s conceptual efforts, but it's ultimately the music that makes it worthy of praise. Tull's winning way with a riff was never so arresting as on the chugging locomotive breath or on the character studies Cross-Eyed Mary and Aqualung, which portray believably seedy participants in Ian Anderson's story. The fable imagery of Mother Goose and the vitriolic anti-authoritarian sentiments of Windup both serve notice of Anderson's willful iconoclasm and his disillusionment with the spiritual traditions to which he was born. So, very heady way of saying that both the lyrics are pretty engaging and the music is great too. Rolling Stones, I thought this was interesting because I read a myriad of, you know, praiseworthy, you know, reviews.
Right, everybody's giving it five out of five stars.
Rolling Stones, back in 1971, this was written, you know, right when it came out, the same year. They had some nice things to say about it musically, but lyrically, it was pretty critical. Which is interesting because a lot of people love Ian Anderson's lyrics. They're pretty cerebral, but they're also very poetic. A lot of people think that he's a fantastic lyricist. I think he's a pretty good lyricist too. I enjoy it. But I just thought this was interesting. It's always kind of nice to kind of throw in a little bit of the other side.
Oh, of course.
Here's what Ben Gerson wrote back in 71. The nub of the issue is Christian hypocrisy, how people manipulate notions of God for their own ends. While Anderson is adept at conceiving a musical approximation of an idea, his lyrics are overly intentional, ponderous, and didactic. It would be possible to ignore the lyrics, as lyrics can usually be ignored, except that Anderson sings them so melodramatically. Nor is his theatricality appropriate to the ideas or words. The overenthusiastic delivery is probably meant to compensate for his inherent vocal limitations. But the original problem is Anderson's choice of subject. At a time when the more arcane varieties of religious experiences are trumpeted far and wide, and atheism and agnosticism still more than hold their own, it is difficult for the modern temper to get worked up over good old-fashioned Christian hypocrisy. Despite the fine musicianship and often brilliant structural organization of songs, this album is not elevated, but undermined by its seriousness. So I think he's saying that there's not enough self-irony and the album takes itself a little too seriously.
A little too seriously.
Religious hypocrisy. I don't know if I would agree with that, actually. I mean, that was a pretty well-worded review, but I feel like there are moments of kind of jokiness, moments where Anderson is kind of laughing and some of his lyrics are ironic. I see what he's saying, though. There are some times where he's just blatantly saying, like on Wind Up, he's basically, you know, I don't know if he based it on himself, but those lyrics are kind of like when I was a schoolboy going there, you're telling me that, you know, he's, you know, a God You Have to Wind Up on Sunday, and you guys are only taking him seriously on Sunday, and the rest of the week you're basically pretending that he's not there, God, or, you know. But so I can see kind of the seriousness there, but there are moments in the way that Anderson sings it, his inflections, his vocal inflections on certain things are kind of ironically dramatic. I don't know. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, he says melodramatic, but I think that melodrama is the irony, is the kind of jokiness and the lightheartedness while still making a point about hypocrisy. I don't know.
I relate him to somebody like Peter Gabriel. Okay. So both are very big showmen, right? They are, if you've seen anything live with Ian Anderson, like, the dude's kind of manic and people think that he's like on drugs, which he's not, which is the funny part about it. In my opinion, it's just like, there's something wrong with this guy. And he's like, no, that's just him. You know, yeah. Like, that's
his
funny.
His eyes bug out of his head.
Yeah. So I kind of relate between the two, but I think that one of the distinctual differences between the two is I think Ian Anderson's a little bit more kind of like wacky. I don't know. It's easy for me to take Peter Gabriel more seriously than it is Ian Anderson, I think.
Well, the garb of Gabriel, the costuming.
Sure.
Ian Anderson's theatrical, and a lot of prog rock in general was kind of theatrical.
Yep.
You know, because it's conceptual and experimental and all that kind of stuff. And that applies to not only the music, but also the presentation of the music. But, you know, on stage and everything. But Gabriel is just so... He really wraps himself up in the characters that he's portraying.
It's pretty diehard stuff there.
The images that he's doing that you're like, whoa, he's really going all in. So it's kind of, you're like, you don't think with that much effort going into it that they're really being ironic themselves,
mm-hmm.
or self-criticizing, you know? There's a lot of gravitas and the grandiose nature to Peter Gabriel and Genesis in their early days, whereas Ian Anderson just seems a bit more grounded and seems like he could be kind of jokey. You know, because he is kind of flamboyant on stage too, but there aren't like as many characters that like he dresses up as.
No, most definitely. But he's also, I think, a little bit more accessible too. I've heard a lot more from Ian Anderson in terms of quotes and interviews and stuff. Like, he's a very approachable and easy to find guy in terms of, what do you want to know? What you want to know what Ian Anderson's thinking? You could probably figure that out on whatever subject. And so, yeah, that probably gives it a little bit of the personal effect to it. But we're talking about the concept of this briefly. I think that was kind of what we were diving into from the Rolling Stone review, saying that they were, they were not necessarily saying that the concept or there was or was not a concept, right? In that review, they weren't mentioning anything about that, right?
Well, they were talking about the lyrical themes throughout.
Okay.
And that kind of goes into the concept of...
Sure.
Or the topic of, is it a concept album or is it not? And you had mentioned that at the beginning.
Yes.
Right? That there is a big, big point of contention between, you know, fans and Ian Anderson. And within the fan community, I'm sure a lot of people agree with Ian Anderson that it's not. But some people contend that it is a concept record.
Yeah.
And that's something that we definitely wanted to address on here. I think, you know, Ian Anderson says that this is not a concept record. You know, that mm-hmm. would come later on their next record, where they are kind of parodying, they are satirizing the idea of a concept record by making two tracks, right, that are each like 20 minutes long.
Yep.
Making these big epics and that are all part of the same thing. In fact, it's like part one and part two. Like, they have lots of different movements. It's kind of, in a way, he's kind of making fun of the long song, the big epics that a lot of the bands at the time were releasing. And, you know, tying it all together with one central theme and story and characters, yada, yada, yada. This one, a lot of people were saying that it was, because of the themes that were presented especially with side two. I mean, I think a lot of people have kind of divided this album up between two different sides, side one and side two. And yes, each of them kind of have their own theme, their own concept.
Yep.
So this is an interesting interpretation of the concepts from a user on AllMusic. They said, side one gives us a series of character sketches. Aqualung, the ominous but pathetic homeless pervert, warming his feet with urine and eyeing little girls with bad intent. Cross-eyed Mary, socialist schoolgirl, escort, and whatever the hell is going on in this swirl of folktales and nursery rhymes that make up Mother Goose. Yeah. Side two is an extended dissection of organized religion versus individual spirituality, with My God and Hymn 43 attacking the church as Wind Up seeks the notion of God outside of doctrine. Sorry, of God outside of doctrine and practice. Tying the two halves together are a series of autobiographical sketches, mini songs from the perspective of a British folk rocker going about his daily life.
Yeah.
Between these two halves, the album is still greater than the sum of its part. Ian Anderson's flute and vocals and Martin Barre's guitar never sounded better. The songwriting is rambling when it needs to be and tight otherwise, fusing folk, hard rock, classic, and prog together more successfully than anyone else. Even early Genesis never got the proportions as right as this album does. Locomotive breath alone is worth the price of admission. So, yeah, that's kind of the two sides. Is side one is kind of this series of character sketches, and side two is the three main songs on side two are My God, Hymn 43, and Wind Up, where all of them are attacking people's or organized religion in general, and also how they manipulate, you know, the concept of God to serve their own ends. And I think I've read places that that Ian Anderson has said, this is not a criticism of God. This is a criticism, of the
people.
Church.
It's people.
Right.
Yeah.
It's people and people within the church, you know, and how they behave, what they say versus what they're actually doing, you know?
Yeah. So it has like a wide, it's wide range of themes. Like, we're going from like defects of urbanization on nature to like social alienation to a degree, social constructs of religion on society, and then there's like some, I guess, liturgical musings happening with some of the stuff on side B, but then there's also locomotive breath. That's just there. That's talking about overpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
When kind of getting into the argument of the concept album or nah. Yeah, sorry. We should make that a segment. Concept album or nah.
Mm.
Yeah, I like that. N-A-W. N-A-W.
Oh.
But, you know, if we're gonna assume that Ian Anderson knows what he's talking about, or if we agree with what he's saying, that it's not a concept album, I think there are certain things and elements that, like Aqualung, this character, I didn't really dive into that, if he is a character or some sort of reference, because he gets referenced in Cross-Eyed Mary, and I think it gets referenced one more place throughout the album outside of just the title track. But do you have anything on that, or anything that you saw with how he kind of gets tied into certain tracks on the album?
Well, the only thing that I can think of that he is specifically mentioned on, like you said, is Cross-Eyed Mary. Again, I'm trying to remember the lyrics right now. If he was on other tracks, he may have been on one other on side two.
Yeah, I thought he was on one more. I don't remember which one though.
Right.
I didn't dive too much into that because of
That he's even referenced on another track kind of lends itself to the idea of it being a concept record, because it's like this character can exist outside of one song, which typically doesn't happen on, you know, non-concept records.
Yep.
Right? You know, it's usually isolated within, it's contained within the one track, the character. If you like, I don't know, Lovely Rita on Sgt. Pepper's, right?
Yep.
It's just that song. Lovely Rita is a character that they made up or whatever, right? And it's just that song, right? I guess that's kind of a bad example because we talk about how Sgt. Pepper might be a concept album.
Sure.
Anyways.
Just welcome to a different album, I guess.
Yeah. Or maybe Abbey Road, Sun King. There you go.
There you go. There you go.
He's not mentioned anywhere
else. But you know, there's a quote from Ian Anderson that's talking about when it comes to the concept album. And what he says here is that he says, I've always said at the time that this is not a concept album, just an album of varied songs, of varied instrumentation and intensity, right, in which three or four are the kind of keynote pieces for the album. But that, right, but it doesn't make it a concept album. So he's, right, he's already signifying the fact that, like, yeah, there's a couple of keynote pieces that may have some crossover in terms of maybe some character or I guess I couldn't really say thematically because it just kind of range. Maybe there's some crossover there. But yeah, it's kind of having that. Is there, if one thread is streaming throughout the album, does it make it a concept album? Because I think that's really the only argument that anybody else has to stand on, is that there's kind of this thread of a character or the Aqualung character, something like that, that's going throughout maybe the whole record in certain ways, if, well, there's references to it or not.
And if you really wanted to reach, you could make the argument that, like, it's still talking about the seediness of human nature in general.
Sure.
In the sense that, you know, you've got all these people on side two, believers or congregants of a church, or just the organized structure of the church in general being hypocritical, and they are very sinful or whatever. But are they act as if they're better, but they're not any better than the pervert Aqualung or the prostitute cross-eyed Mary. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So you could make the notion where it's like they're all kind of tied together in that kind of a sense. I don't know. That's just off the top of my head.
No, that, I mean, that's a,
where you're these characters, yeah, are on the underside of society, right? Inside one, right? We've got Aqualung, we've got Cross-Eyed Mary. And then on side two, we have these congregants that hold themselves up to a quote unquote higher standard or a higher calling. Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah,
but they're no better, right? It's a criticism, but they're no better than the underbelly of, you know, and the dregs of society. You could fuse those two together. However.
You could.
However.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Those are just a couple of songs. There are some songs in the middle that don't have anything
nothing
to do with those.
That's exactly what I'm talking,
right,
about.
Wondering Aloud has, yes, nothing to do. Neither, you know, nor does, what am I trying to say? Slipstream?
Slipstream.
I don't see any thread there connecting Wondering Aloud and Slipstream and Cheap Day Return.
Right.
To those, if you were to even fuse those two concepts together, the characters inside one and the criticism of the church on the second half.
Yep.
So, you know, ultimately, I think I agree with Anderson, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see a common thread pulling throughout. However, the themes are pretty strong and prominent within those songs. And the fact that there's more than, I would say, two or three on just a what? Is it a 12-track album? Forgive me.
12
it's
songs?
11. Sorry, 11? Yeah. 11. You know, on both sides, there are threads on both sides. I totally understand where it's interpreted as such. But, mm-hmm, I have to agree, ultimately, if I'm to make like a decision,
yeah,
it doesn't really seem like a concept album.
Yeah. I'm going to agree with Anderson on it. Because and yep, notice as well that the only thing that we are mentioning or talking about is purely lyrical. Because musically, there's nothing here that would give me any sort of motif. Now, the Aqualung character or whatever could be a motif, but there's nothing musically, from what I heard from a couple of times that I was listening to it, trying to listen for some sort of, like, is there any sort of musical motif that's coming back to? I couldn't find anything.
Right, some type of callback or anything?
Yes, some, yeah, sort of callback or something within that spans throughout the album that ties it together musically, and I couldn't find anything. So if it is going to be a quote-unquote concept album, it's going to be purely lyrical. And even that, we have side A, side B split, with one song on side B not necessarily fitting within the other ones, like My God, Hymn 43, and
Wind Up.
And Wind Up. But then you have Locomotive Breath, which I can't find any connection between those two things, the overpopulation and the what I'm going to call is very pharisaical approach to the criticism of the church, which... is what he was talking about. But then you have the front part of it, which is more of the human nature side of it kind of thing. Like, it's a little bit more grounded at the very beginning, and then it sort of like kind of takes a little bit more of a philosophical or maybe somewhat of conceptual idea for B, for the side B. But ultimately, I would have to agree with Anderson on this.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Though I can't totally fault someone for thinking that it is.
No.
And
yeah.
Crud, you could, you know, these are just off the top of my head. We were talking about, you know, where it could be considered a concept album. I'm sure there are a lot more arguments out there online that I haven't read.
Oh, we didn't go.
So if you think it is, that would be an interesting thing. If
yeah.
you want to let us know if you think it is a concept record, make an argument for it. It'd be fun.
Oh, of course.
It's always fun.
We don't have all the answers.
No.
We just,
these are our prog notes. Thanks for listening. Shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really on that regard. So, so with that being the case, I guess we could sort of move on into, I guess, the next subject that we really wanted to talk about with this record is that, is it progressive rock?
Yeah.
Is this album
from the specificity of concept record, which is a common element in prog rock,
yeah.
to just prog rock in general, broader. What about this is prog rock? What about this isn't prog rock? Jethro Tull is commonly referred to as that. Granted, and they probably agree with that now, or at the very least know that they've been labeled as that. But I don't think that that's something that they wanted to endeavor to be called, or they were trying to be called. I know, yes, in King Crimson, they wanted to be that. They wanted to experiment, and the label prog rock fit for them. That's what they wanted. Jethro Tull is interesting, and I'm going to compare it to their next record, where they were actively trying to be progressive rock.
Mm.
I re-listened to sections of Thick as a Brick, and there are so many more organs, so many more keys in there, which is very common. This record is a lot earthier. It has an earthy sound to it. It's a very rooted sound. It's very basic. As far as the production on it doesn't seem overblown, which progressive rock can, because you're experimenting with a lot of different sounds in the studio. So, you know, this sounds very folky. And Destin and I were talking about this earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very folk-oriented record, and hard rock and blues. Yeah, it seems very grounded and very raw.
Yeah.
So,
not to mention the fact that the name of the band is an agriculturalist. Like Jethro Tull was like an agriculturalist from the 1700s or something like that, which, you know, just sort of gives that earthy kind of feel to it. And I think which is almost like a very stark contrast to something like we did previously, like Ocean by Eloy, you know, something very up in space.
Yes.
Very up in the
absolutely.
Air.
Absolutely.
This
is
kind of like, you know,
you know
what I mean?
I didn't even make that connection. It's really interesting, because we did this record because we, you know, we knew it was a popular prog rock record. We thought it was time to cover this.
Uh-huh.
But that's so interesting, Destin,
it's
that
like
our last record is, that like polar opposite.
Yeah.
It's all out in space. It's all cosmic. And
yep.
then this one is so rooted. I
yep.
think that's a good term for it. It's rooted and very earthy, and it's down here. It's down to earth. Type of deal from a musical standpoint,
most definitely. And it's also too in terms of like the and I also should mention this as well, and I know that we've briefly mentioned that or maybe we've said it multiple times, to go check out Thick as a Brick, but we also do a little bit more of a history on the band in terms of like talking about the, you know, where the band name came from and stuff like that. So if you're interested in that, we're not covering that in this episode, but you can go listen to that if you're not familiar or want to know. In Thick as a Brick, we didn't want to repeat ourselves. So, but I think that's like the earthy feel to it. That doesn't make it progressive. Like that's not, at least to me, like they're not the first band to combine folk rock, heavy metal guitar riffs, and bluesy rock, like, or blues rock. They weren't the first people to do that, nor were they the first rock band to have even a flute as a lead instrument. You know,
they were one of the first.
One of the first.
They were one of the first.
Not the first. You know what I'm saying? So it's not like they were, I don't know. It just, when I, they weren't the first person to do this or this or this. Maybe they were one of the more popular groups that did that. But I think for them, and this is just some of the research that I did. You can argue with this, Drew. But I think outside of the time period of progressive rock that was going on, right, I think we listen to albums sometimes, and we listen to it and we label it prog rock due to the notion of what we think of when we think 70s progressive rock at the time, and maybe 70s in the UK, something like that. But if you look at each band individually, and looking at specifically at Jethro Tull, you know, their last three albums, the first one being 1968, this was 1969 Stand Up, which most people would argue that that was kind of like the first real Jethro Tull album, because they were starting to figure out their deal. And then 1970 Benefit. Over the course of those three albums, they had gone from a fairly standard blues rock outfit into something a little bit more dynamic and progressive for them. Like, this was very, this was a lot more outside of the blues stuff for them, making it more progressive for Jethro Tull. Now, but that's the argument, right? It's like, does that make it progressive rock just in general, or does it make
that's so funny,
right?
Because you and I both, like, independently arrived. This is the first time I'm hearing you say this, but this is the exact same stuff that I had thought of.
Dude, we should host a podcast.
Gosh, it's like these thoughts, we're just expressing them and no, but it's funny because we have not discussed this previously.
That's
but
funny.
I have this exact train of thought like written down here.
That's
them, and because they are called progressive rock, because they are known as that, like, you look them up online and people will use a lot of different terms, but almost all of them will concede that they were at least identified, even if you don't identify them as that.
Right.
They were called progressive rock.
Yeah.
Right. And this was the start. I think this record specifically was very much the start in that direction, because they're fusing a lot of different instruments together and those genres together, and their lyrics were very cerebral. And the fact that some people consider this a concept record, whether you do or not, but there was that talk amongst, you know, music historians, fans of music, and just listeners in general, hey, this is kind of similar to a concept record like Sgt. Pepper's, or, you know, these wacky characters like 21st Century Schizoid Man and The Court of the Crimson King. And they're using some classical instruments. Now, not nearly as much as, you know, Days of Future Past or some of the other groups. But, you know, you've got string sections on pieces like what am I trying to think of? Wondering Aloud, I believe. And a couple of other, I think Slipstream has that as well, if I'm not mistaken. But sorry, I had it written down and then it was got erased somewhere.
No, you can find it.
Anyways, I think those are right. But they have those classical instruments. They also have a Mellotron on the record as well.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember which track that is, because they don't use it very often, right?
No. Right.
But, you know, they are considered progressive rock, and this was progressive for them. And then the fact that they evolved to Thick as a Brick, maybe evolved is the wrong term, because they did it kind of as a joke.
I have the quote from that, too, if we want to just kind of hear straight from Ian Anderson.
Sure, that'd be great.
He said, in my mind, when it came to writing the next album, Thick as a Brick, Thick as a Brick was done very much in the sense of, well, if they thought Aqualung was a concept album, oh, okay, we'll show you a concept album. And it was done as kind of a spoof, a send up of a concept album, of the concept album genre.
So, and I think we had mentioned this on the last one, where it wasn't, I don't think it was supposed to be particularly negative or denigrating to the genre of prog rock. It was critical, because I think he was saying they were getting too far up their own butts. You know, they were getting too aggrandizing in a way. They were taking it too seriously. And so Thick as a Brick is kind of a joke on that. But at the same time, it's not saying that we don't like some of the fact that they're, or we hate it, right? It's kind of this good-natured ribbing type of deal.
Which is funny, too, because, you know, as the progressive rock stuff, we were just talking about a minute ago, is that with people going the progressive rock and it got like super synthy and like, you know, they're experimenting with all the keyboard sounds. We got the Mellotron stuff. We got the spacey guitar stuff that's going on. And Ian Anderson's over here with his acoustic guitar and flute. And he's like, what the heck are you guys doing?
Yeah. I mean, you know, people tie like sci-fi and fantasy to progressive rock, like lyrically and also musically. Like that's what you think of. This record doesn't elicit that kind of a motif or feeling whatsoever. It's very rooted. Again, it's very rooted. It's not very imagination inducing. Maybe that's the bad way to do it, because they have colorful characters as well, like Aqualung, whatever. But it's very rooted. It's very real. And even his voice sounds very gruff, right? I mean,
yeah, crud,
listen to what we're listening to right now.
Yep.
Right? This is him 43, right?
Yep.
Here's what I wrote. I would say that it definitely deserves to be covered on this show, on Rock Notes, because it paved the way to their more progressive rock sound, like we talked about.
Yep.
It's like how we covered Sgt. Pepper's. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band back on episode 4. Many might not think of the Beatles as a prog rock band, but they were integral in its early development. And I would say the Aqualung has a similar function, particularly for Jethro Tull. Even if they weren't trying to be King Crimson or Yes or ELP, they were producing more sophisticated music and fusing, you know, some different styles together with more highbrow lyrics. I mean, Ian Anderson's just kind of a highbrow guy in general. So, and also, look at the section 350 and like something like My God, a flute solo, and then having the choir in the background slowly accelerate their chanting and then ease the tempo back down following the flute. I mean, that's super prog, right? I mean, you know. So even though I would say that this album is rooted more in sounds akin to folk and hard rock and blues rock, I think this is a prog rock album because it eventually led to them becoming a prog rock band. And the structures of the songs also, if you're looking at that element, are pretty atypical. Some of them are pretty straightforward. Some of them are super short. Some of them are a bit longer, and they don't follow the typical verse one, verse two, chorus, blah, blah, blah type of pop-oriented or typical early rock and roll structure.
Yeah.
So, why might some say that it's not? There aren't very many keyboards or synthesized sounds, common element of the genre. But at the same time, it's accented with distorted guitars and has some really raucous grooving sections like Locomotive Breath and everything. So, I think it is prog rock. But this is a very interesting record because, like I said earlier when I was diving into the reviews, this does not conjure the word progressive rock to mind if you were to listen to this first. Like, this is an album that you would not start off someone on with prog rock to be like, this is what prog rock sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
No, this is definitely one of the outliers, I believe, in terms of
which is interesting
the sound.
Because it's early on in its development, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's during the whole thing, like other albums, progressive rock had come before it, but it's still pretty early on, right? Because we're saying 1969 is quote unquote the first, you know, prog rock album, which people attribute to in the Court of the Crimson King.
Yep.
But that's still pretty early on. This was early 1971, Aqualung. So this is only a year or two into this genre, a couple years into it. So it's interesting that it's not really proggy. But it's early on.
Yep. So. It's always worth going back to at the time of when something was written and seeing how it kind of
fits in to
the current situation of the music or not the current time period. Right.
Right.
Because this is it's 71. Right. So, I mean, what has come out? Trespass, Genesis, In the Court of the Crimson King, King Crimson. Sergeant Pepper's,
Tarkus,
B.O.P.
Actually, Tarkus, I don't know if that was before. It was the same year. But even so, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, their debut record, which had a lot of the iconic Keith Emerson sound.
Yeah.
And they were definitely going for the direction of prog rock, even in their early days, ELP, I mean. So, yeah,
but who
has come out.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm assuming that Ian Anderson was familiar enough with some of those other bands that were happening at the time.
Right, and I think those bands were gaining a lot of traction because people were noticing them. I mean, Yes was really their jaws dropped when they saw King Crimson live. They're like, oh my gosh, they're really doing some cool stuff and doing interesting stuff. And again, the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's, we talked about how influential that record was for a lot of the prog rock legends and pioneers to begin with. But like you said, these were little flashpoints, and they were still, when they were writing this record, in the early days of it. Stuff had come out, but this was still the beginning.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And so I think just to our knowledge now and looking back on it and seeing all of the other records that we find as some of the staple prog rock albums, right?
Right.
I mean, Metal was out right at this point.
I think it came out later this year.
Later this year?
Later 1971.
I thought it was 70.
No. Metal is 1971.
Okay.
Yeah.
So either way, so that's coming, but like this is like pre-Dark Side or pre-Rush 2112. This is pre
Right.
You know, some of the heavier stuff. So I find it to be progressive in that sense of just at the time period, I believe.
Yes.
Of course, that, you know, now what I listen to and I relate all of the stuff that came out after and I really relate it back to this, I'm like, I don't know. But it always has to go back to the time period and the time of which it was released.
Yes.
To see if it stands up against the other albums at the time. And then also, as we've seen before, that this kind of paved the way for a lot of other rock and roll bands. Something that I think we briefly mentioned on, I think it was actually on our, something before. You previously mentioned there was a question that, what is a band that comes to mind that you could call them progressive rock, but it just doesn't feel like it? Like, it's like, I don't know, I just can't. Yeah. And you said Led Zeppelin.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the one that I instantly think of.
Yes. It's like, you could call it progressive
rock, but
it
doesn't feel right to say it that.
Right. Yeah.
To say that. But at the same time, they evolve from their beginnings and use a lot of the elements that were very commonly used in the prog rock movement. They have more synthesized sounds. Some of their lyrics pertain to flipping J.R.R. Tolkien.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah.
And right. Yeah. Throughout, even in their early stuff, actually, before they even evolved, but even, you know, but yeah, a lot of the sounds of the keys start to get a little bit more intricate in there. They start to utilize orchestras with stuff like the Rain Song and like heavy mellotron and something like the Rain Song, and everything. They still retain their identity as being kind of rooted in hard rock. Like you can't,
yes.
But like, I mean, you listen to something like Carolus Ambra in Through the Outdoor.
Yep.
Right. And that was 1978. Yeah. Anyways, and Physical Graffiti, they've got some really cool key yes. parts in there and stuff like In the Light on side two
yes.
of, or yeah, disc two of Physical Graffiti. That's kind of, they paint some really interesting soundscapes and tapestries that you wouldn't hear in a typical hard rock sort of deal, that you wouldn't hear in a typical like Cream song or Jimi Hendrix tune or whatever. Not mm-hmm. to denigrate them at all, they're fabulous musicians and I love rock, but just kind of separates them from that sort of ilk, right? And
yeah.
kind of, so anyways, that's my very small argument as to why Led Zeppelin could maybe be considered prog rock, but again, it doesn't feel right to identify them, you know, instantly as prog rock.
Yeah. And I think it was the one of the two things, and this is what I was kind of trying to tie into, is that for one, Jethro Tull opened for Led Zeppelin. You know, they went on tour with him, so that was there was a similarity that's going on between both of these two bands. But secondly as well is that they're both very, very based in the blues rock stuff.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, yes.
Most of the flute stuff that we're hearing on this record is in the blues scale. It's in the pentatonic mm-hmm. kind of thing. Most of the stuff that was coming from, you know, like Led Zeppelin is very bluesy. And I think, and this is going to be some of my argument for this, with being with Led Zeppelin and the progressive rock stuff. I think there is an image that we think of when we think progressive rock. And I think part of it is the nerdiness, right? It's the social outcasts. Think Steve Howe, for example. You know, somebody that looks, you know, kind of maybe a little out there. And so I think there's a little bit of an image here. Led Zeppelin were pure rockers, like they were rock and roll
yes.
stage men, and I think that may have given them the image of they're a rock and roll band rather
yes.
than they're a progressive rock band because of that image, maybe
totally
outside
say,
of the music aspect of it. This is just sort of kind of like looking at it from face value of just looking
yes,
at that band
again,
and thinking what kind of band they are.
Well, later on, sorry, I'm just going to interrupt real quick.
Uh-huh.
Later on, again, they do have 100%, totally agree with you. And that's why it's kind of difficult to say that they are prog rock, is because
yeah.
they had that image. However, again, some of the stuff that they later did, like they had the symbols attached to each member.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting what each of them is. They had the feather. They had Zoso.
Yes.
They had the peace sign. I need to look up the symbols again. But they had those four symbols that represented each member of the band.
Yes.
And even just having something as small as that was an idea that is kind of a prog thing, to symbolize something, to have some type of, you know, image that represents something else, right?
Yeah.
That's very literary. That's very, you know what I mean? That's
yes,
very cinematic.
Most definitely.
In a way, right? And so you have that. And again, you have the lyrics of like, they reference Gollum
mm-hmm.
and ramble on. Gollum. And the evil one snuck up and swept away with her. Gollum? You're referencing a specific character.
Yeah.
And then later on, they've got, you know, the Battle of Evermore, right? They do have lyrics that are kind of sci-fi. But then again, like you say, they ground it with something like literally a song called Rock and Roll.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long time since I rock and roll. That makes them super grounded, super relatable, super early blues,
rock and
early
roll.
Hard rock and roll
yeah.
type of stuff that really kind of cemented them as that. But again, anyways, sorry.
Yep. No, so with that being said... With that being said,
this is still like, a Jethro Tull.
This is still episode, Jethro Tull, right? All of that was meaning to say is that there are ties between the two. But that was one of the things that we suggested is that Led Zeppelin maybe could be a progressive rock band. We don't really know, but we could definitely say that Jethro Tull is. And there's a lot of similarities with them between the blues stuff, because a lot of progressive rock is based in the classical side of things. This is very bluesy, right? So we have that aspect mm-hmm. of it between these bands. That between these two bands that are very, very similar. Hey, they also toured together as well, so there's probably some similar aspect of maybe the fan base. Maybe some of the fans like
yeah,
Led
absolutely.
Zeppelin and Jethro Tull at the exact same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we want to suggest that Jethro Tull is progressive rock and Led Zeppelin may not be. Now, I don't know what everybody else is thinking if you think that Led Zeppelin is a progressive rock band or not. To my knowledge, to most people that I've talked to, I have never seen anybody group Led Zeppelin in with a bunch of other the 70s progressive rock bands. I've never, like Pink Floyd, Rush, Genesis, Yes, and stuff like that. I've never seen anybody group in Led Zeppelin
right
with ease.
Exactly.
I imagine. But Jethro Tull gets looped into that. EOP, Jethro Tull, Camel, Caravan,
yes.
they get grouped into that.
Yes.
So I wanted to bring up just a brief discussion about this is of if they're, I'm kind of relating the two, what makes Jethro Tull kind of stand out a little bit higher as progressive rock band than something like
Led
Zeppelin.
Is it because they made Thick as a Brick? Because they did something that was actively, even though it was a parody, it was actively incorporating progressive rock elements that the other prog rock bands were doing at the time. Long songs.
Good point.
Organs and key solos and all of that kind of stuff. A character that is throughout the whole thing, right? One central, you know, concept and story. Is it because they made something like that? Is it because there's a flute incorporated as like the main instrument and people are like, that's cool and different, and that's not something that's typical in
right.
blues and hard rock? I mean, right, that's a fantastic question, Destin. What makes them more prog rock than Led Zeppelin as they evolved later on in their career from like, I would say 73 or 74
sure.
onwards, right? From Houses of the Holy onwards is kind of really where I think they started to evolve more personally.
Yep.
So that's a great question.
Yeah. I don't have the answer.
It's just a fun discussion.
Posing the question. Yeah.
It's a fun discussion.
Because I know that now we look back on it and we suggest that Jethro Tull is a progressive rock band.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is prior, but go back to the time period, right? This is prior to Thick as a Brick. This is prior to the outright spoof of a concept album, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
People were still suggesting that this is a concept album. Were they also suggesting that this was progressive rock at the time?
Right.
I
don't know. I wasn't during the time.
I don't know.
Some of our listeners are older and actually lived through that. Some of our listeners
yes.
lived through it. So I would actually love to know. That would be great if anyone
yes.
wants to call in or be on Discord or whatever and let us know. Like, hey, at the time that this was released, was this being designated as prog rock or progressive rock?
And most of the research that I was doing, because I was looking some of this up. I couldn't find any reviews from the time period. I couldn't find any like pretty staple reviews at the time it was written. I don't know if you did.
Well, I did, but it was more so in the vein of they were just reviewing it as like music in general and lyrical and musical. Like I didn't, from what I remember, I don't remember seeing the term like progressive rock.
Progressive rock or something like that. May have to do like a Google search or something.
Yeah.
There is a very fine line that this album really sits on, and I find it to be very, very
yeah.
interesting. I do too.
It's fascinating.
It's yeah. fascinating and a little bit challenging, too, to try and digest as well as to explain.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are other people out there that have way more knowledge than we do. And so you can let us know. Come join our Discord community and talk to us about it. But that's just one of the things I wanted to throw up in the air for everybody totally. Just maybe to think about a little bit.
This is where it really kind of skirts the line of prog rock. And you're like, well, what is and what isn't? Mm-hmm. And in mm-hmm. general, it's kind of difficult to put a label on anything.
Sure,
I think.
Of course. Most of the time, I hate them anyway. Most of the time, I hate the labels.
Right.
But for the sake of the masses understanding this term or that term or this term, right. You know, I refer to them as elements rather than terms.
It's fascinating that it's not, you know, this skirts the line between progressive rock and is it yep. or is it not, and labels and everything in general.
Yep.
So
most definitely.
But I think another thing to note is that this was a popular album in general, not just in prog rock. This was just
yes.
a popular record in music in general. And I think it's important why we talk about just some of the elements that make it so popular, that make it unique and fun and all of that, that people really love. And you know, this took me several listens to really kind of get into, and I'm liking it a whole lot more now. I didn't dislike it to begin with. But I will say upon each successive listen, there are more things that kind of stood out to me that were unique and fun and interesting. Ian Anderson's laughs. I love his tiny little laughs, and he does it in Thick as a Brick as well every now mm-hmm. and then. But it adds so much character and personality. It adds this realness to it and this richness to it as well. When he's like, yeah, we don't slow down. I love that. You can just hear him kind of laughing and smiling in the studio as he's going on. I love it when any musician does that. You hear that in some of the Beatles stuff too. And it makes me really happy when that happens. Especially in, like, you don't hear that very much in prog rock because, again, it takes itself pretty seriously.
It's kind of serious,
in certain
areas.
Yeah. Anyways, I love that. The flute is something of note. I know that's kind of like the big grabby thing with this band, but I understand why. When you listen to My God and Locomotive Breath and stuff like that, you're like, that's impressive. That's
yes.
really cool. I mean, you know, Peter Gabriel was also a flautist. He never did anything like this, though.
No.
And that's not, again, to kind of badmouth his abilities or capabilities at all. But
it just shows the uniqueness of Ian Anderson.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. This is a lots of notes. They're very, it's shredding. You know,
no,
how
seriously.
Guitar, you shred a solo. He's shredding flute, you know, throughout this record. And it's very fun. You can't, like, it's just fun when
it
you
is.
Hear some, like, you know, the solo in My God or Locomotive Breath or something. And
yeah.
And especially when he gets so into it, because it's a lot of breath, right? It's a lot of breath control. And you can hear that, right? Whenever you play any woodwind, right, as opposed to manipulating it synthetic or, you know, synthesizer on a computer program, you hear the musician breathing, right, in the microphone. You hear that kind of right into it, and that
yep.
kind of adds some authenticity to it. And especially with Ian Anderson, when you kind of hear him going, ugh! He kind of
yes.
every now and then will give a little
yes.
gasp, all right, this little exclamation every now and then when he's getting into it. I think if you hear him kind of go, yeah, like, yeah, and that's so fun. It just gives
yeah.
this extra layer of intensity and authenticity, this humanness to it. This, you know, you can hear him sweating bullets
mm-hmm.
as he's playing this because he's just so into it.
He's just going hard.
That's just, yeah.
It's he, great.
Dude, you're going hard, man.
He's going crazy. But, like, I think that was one of my, or it is one of my draws to this, is that I honestly have never heard anything like it. I haven't.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything like it. Flute to me is, and I guess in the prog rock capacity, most of that I've heard is coming from Peter Gabriel, but the rest of it usually comes from like a classical orchestral
right.
kind of sense.
Absolutely.
Which is very, very clean. It's very pure at its natural form of just playing the instrument. It's a very smooth instrument. And I love that he just rips that and throws it out the window with this thing.
Yeah.
And
totally.
And, because he did, you know, Ian Anderson started playing guitar. And
yes.
And I think what he said is, and I have a quote here. He started playing guitar. He didn't he wanted to be like the next rock star, right? Just like every other kid at that time.
Yeah, I read that too.
Right? Yeah. But he knew that he wasn't going to be the next Jimmy Page. So this is what he says. I quote here. I didn't want to be just another third-rate guitar player who sounded like a bunch of other third-rate guitar players. I wanted to do something that was a little bit more idiosyncratic, hence to the switch to another instrument. When Jethro Tull began, I think I'd been playing flute for about 2 weeks. It was a quick learning curve. Literally every night I walked on stage was a flute lesson. And I find that so cool because there's some humility there of understanding that I'm not going to be that, so I got to find something that I got to be. Like, I can't be that, so I got to find something that is going to make me me and make me stand out and be different. And so, and with the some of the aggressiveness that he takes from playing something like a tin whistle, which he had a little bit of experience playing, I actually have a quick little audio clip of Ian Anderson talking about his flute playing and his little bit of his technique. Check this out.
And I would chirp and burst the notes out to give them a bit more viciousness. And I learned that, strangely, not from any other flute player, but from the tin whistle, because you could trill into a tin whistle and make it really penetrating, rather like a bird whistle, you know, like a pea in an old-fashioned whistle. And the saxophone you could growl into. I knew because there was a saxophone player in one of our bands in Blackpool, and he would... Sometimes, you know, he could growl into the mouthpiece when he blew, and so I emulated that thing of, rather than play a pure note, I go and make it aggressive. So I was certainly not the best flute player in town. I was the loudest flute player in town. That was my sole credential when we started.
I know that is, I love that. Isn't that great? But I know that was one of the things that started having him stand out when they were playing at the Marquee Club. When they were kind of first starting out as a band,
right.
He said that was one of the things that were like, oh, which it is. I mean, that's right. Something very, very different. I saw this quote online. They said this, the flute bridges the gap between the acoustic folk influence track with the harder rock tracks. The flute unifies this album. And I couldn't agree more with that. I think that really does help keep it grounded, but because it is sort of a, like we were talking about earlier, kind of a rooted, earthy kind of instrument. But with the way that he expresses and the way that he plays this instrument is in a very rock way. And so it's kind of tying some of these two elements together.
That's what I'm saying is I wouldn't say that the flute is an earthy or grounded instrument. It's not spacey, but it seems more elevated and sophisticated and elegant.
Yeah.
It's more elegant than it is earthy and kind of gruff and real and, you know, all of that. I would say it's elegant because it's orchestral, and usually I hear it in these big, grandiose symphonies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With lots of beautiful strings. But to your point, to totally agree with you, he puts it in like a rock sense and, you know, and feeling, right? With doing the, what he was just talking about, the chirping and the very fast. Right? The trills and all of that.
And the growling, which as soon as he said that, the first thing that came to my mind was the sax solo on Us and Them, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
on Money, yeah, when he does that sort of growly saxophone stuff, which I love.
Yeah.
So good. So good. But that's probably, at least to me, that's the standout part of this record. Fun fact, though, I saw this online because I know that's me talking from the flute perspective, but I saw that online, Martin Barre's guitar solo from in Guitar World, they had a 100 greatest guitar solos. They put Aqualung at number 25.
Wow.
And I highly disagree with that. I went back. That was never something that caught my eye. Or caught my ear, rather, when I was listening to that song, was that, wow, that was a freaking epic guitar solo. Not really. I had to go back and listen to it again and be like, oh, wait a minute. Okay, let me go back and listen to it. Then again, I went back and listened to it, and I was like, no, this doesn't strike me. And then I went online on YouTube and watched somebody play a cover of it, because I was like, okay, maybe if I see him play it, that'd be that. Maybe I'll see, like, something different. Maybe I'll see something different. No, not really. I don't know.
No.
I don't know. I'm not saying that Martin is a bad guitar player, but I think that is a... no, I don't know.
I agree. It doesn't really stand out, but I will say I really do like the guitar playing on this record.
The guitar
especially
playing on the Ray playing,
the
yeah.
I think I was talking to you about this earlier, Dustin. The muted strums are so fun on something like Locomotive Breath, and he does that a couple times on the record, but that's where it's really prominent, is that...
Yep.
The way it adds that rhythm.
Yeah.
And again, just makes it sound super rooted and earthy.
Yep. Well, also think, I mean, specifically in that song, you could think of sort of the train, like the train moving.
Exactly. That, yeah, exactly. That's sort of, the kind yep. of the point of it. That's yep. what it's trying yep. to emulate.
Which is awesome. It's,
yeah. It's really, really cool. There are a lot of good things upon each successive listen to kind of notice about this record. And enjoy, I think. I didn't mention this earlier, I should have. We've been kind of going all around, but we were kind of, you know, comparing and contrasting Jethro Tull and Led Zeppelin. Fun fact, this was recorded in the same studio and at the same time as Led Zeppelin 4.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
So I think that's just kind of yep. funny. And like you said, they toured with them before, so they were clearly, you know...
They knew each other.
Connected.
Yeah, they knew each other.
They were connected.
On the bonus... I guess the bonus edition of the album, which you can buy on iTunes, it comes with like a 15-minute interview with Ian Anderson. And I think one of the things that he was talking about in the interview is that they got along a little bit with Jimmy Page and John Bonham in certain capacities, but
yeah,
Ian
yeah,
Anderson
but...
and Robert Plant didn't really hit it off.
He said something. Ian Anderson apparently publicly, like in an interview or something.
Oh,
so
no.
It wasn't just to a friend. It was publicly he had said something to the effect of, if you combined the music of Led Zeppelin with the lyrics of Jethro Tull, you'd have like a really great band or something, which in a way is kind of, it definitely could be interpreted as kind of throwing rocks at Robert Plant,
Robert Plant,
I think, wrote a lot of the lyrics for Led Zeppelin, being like, your lyrics aren't as good as mine type of deal.
Yep.
And I don't think Ian Anderson really meant it antagonistically. At the very least, in his interview when he's talking about this retrospectively, he claims that it was like, it was absent-minded. I didn't mean for it to be an insult, yada, yada, yada. Who knows? But yeah, that is kind of interesting because Robert Plant was not too happy about that. And I think it rubbed him the wrong way.
Yeah.
So,
I would imagine if somebody said that, like, oh yeah, if they put my lyrics with your music.
Yeah. It is kind of an audacious statement.
Yeah.
I'll give him that. Yeah. I don't. Yeah.
And on the other subject though, kind of another last fun fact though, was that, did you see the whole story about Jimmy Page walking into the studio while they were recording? Have you seen this?
No.
No? Okay. No. So there's a story that Martin Barre quotes, and where they're recording, you know, they were recording in a studio that was sort of converted from a church, which is funny enough about the stuff that they were talking
yeah.
about. And I think that Led Zeppelin got like the better end of the stick on the location of which they were going to be recording their album. While they were recording, here, I'll quote this from Martin Barre. He says, the only thing I can remember, and this is on the subject of cutting the solo for Aqualung, he says, the only thing I can remember about cutting the solo for Aqualung is that Led Zeppelin was recording next door. And as I was playing it, Jimmy Page walked into the control room and waved to me. So here's Jimmy waving at me, waving like mad. Hey, Martin. And I'm thinking, I can't wave back or I'm going to blow the solo. Yeah. Like, I can't do this.
Dude, I'm recording
this solo, bro. But I just thought that was hilarious. I was just like, just imagine you cutting a solo that ends up being like a really, really great solo amongst the public that people really, really enjoy. But Jimmy Page walks into the control room and is just like, hey, how you doing? And you're just kind of like, I got to cut this solo. Now, of course, it probably wasn't like a starstruck kind of thing because they've been on tour with them in the past. So it was just kind of like, oh, hey, Jimmy, kind of thing.
Later on, Jimmy's like, dude, you totally snubbed me. And he's like, dude, I was recording a solo. You can't wave to me then and expect me to wave back.
Yeah, what's your problem?
You know what it's like. You're a guitarist too.
It's hilarious. But anyway, I just thought that was a fun fact that I read. I laughed when I read that because I was just picturing that story, like picturing something like that happen. Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny. So, but anyway.
Yeah,
do you have any final thoughts?
No, I think we actually covered a fair amount of ground here.
Yeah.
This was a fun record. And again, like you say, it's fascinating is it prog or is it not?
Yeah. Is and it like, is it a concept? Is it not? I think those are kind of the
really
two
interesting
big I guess polar arguments
questions
that people are that people brought up. So I guess that was kind of what we wanted to bring most of our attention to, rather than us talk about the opinions or even some of the history of this. We kind of wanted to go through those two questions because we thought they were pretty important. And
it's musical uniqueness.
Absolutely. So awesome. All right. Well, let's wrap this thing up. We would like to thank everybody for listening to our podcast. These are our prog notes for Aqualung. If you enjoyed the episode, you learned something new from the episode, please subscribe and share. We would love that. Go become a special Prog Notes patron at patreon.com/prognotes to support the show. And if you'd like, you can get some access to some extra benefits outside of our episodes. Also, you can come join our Discord server, which is just a chat community for all prog rock fans and fans of the show. You can check the episode's description to join all of those and to check those out. Drew, why don't you go ahead and tell us what the next record on the show is going to be.
Episode 42.
Yes.
The next episode is going to be The Power and the Glory by Gentle Giant.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. Now, like we said at the beginning of the episode, we do have a quick announcement for you guys. We will be taking a two-month break from releasing our episodes to give us a rest. We've honestly just been running at this every month for a little over 3 years now. So
we need a hiatus.
We need a little bit of a break. It's been a lot. So we are going to be returning with The Power and the Glory on January 15th, 2022. At the top of the year, January 15th, we will be releasing this episode.
A powerful and glorious return.
And glorious return. Hence, shoot, that's unreal.
The Power.
The Power and the Glory. But in the meantime, I do want to say this. Spotlight has some amazing bands ready for you to check out. They will be releasing episodes on the 1st, like their normal release date, and the 15th in replacement of our normal episode for these next 2 months. So you're going to get double spotlight for the next 2 months, some extra music for you to check out. We're going to pound you guys with some new stuff, new bands that we're going to be interviewing that you guys can go and listen to. They're really, really cool. Super excited for them. But join us next time as we discover the past, present, and future of prog rock. We will see you all on Discord.